Hello, everybody. It's Federica on the show. So did you hear? Welcome back. It's good to have you with me this rainy afternoon. I'm enjoying the rain. I don't know about you guys. It just feels like a nice, peaceful little breather. So this is the show where I, your host, Federica, take a deep dive into cultural happenings of the moment. I kind of take a deep dive into the current zeitgeist of things that are occupying the, our ever more increasingly busy minds. And just taking a little time to pause and think a little deeper and reflect a little more on the cultural forces that shape our lives today. And with that said, I'm really excited for today's show because I have some guests on the air.
Woo-hoo!
All right.
Yeah. I will, get to your intros here. I have been working on getting some more guests featured on the air for a while, and it's always a really nice treat when I get to do that because I don't mind having my solo shows, but it's just so much more interesting and fun when you have somebody else on the air to share the moment with. So today we're talking about a subject that has occupied a lot of people's attentions. It's a word that's, or I guess I should say a concept that has definitely taken up a lot of space in the modern cultural zeitgeist, but not a lot of people know or fully understand what this term actually refers to. We're talking about restorative justice today, and as my guests, I have Igna Laurent. She is a law professor at Gonzaga, and Julie, as her guest, who she also invited to be on the air to add a little more perspective on the topic, which is super exciting. Julie is a restorative justice consultant. She works with various community organizations and schools. Welcome, Igna and Julie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we got in contact through Linnea. She is also a programmer here at KYRS and has been helping me reach out to different community organizations because I really tried to steer some of my focus on the show as far as having guests on the air to I really wanted to give voice to community organizers and people who are making moves to improve our community here locally. And so it's exciting to have you guys on the air. Thank you for being with me. Igna and Julie partnered together to support the BRC, which is a Building Restorative Communities initiative or a project through the NAACP. Is that correct?
Yep.
All right. I got it right. So, yeah, thank you guys for being here. It's an honor. And, I'm excited to be able to talk about this today because I, like many people, have heard the term restorative justice being thrown around, and it's been the subject of a lot of media, you know, back and forth and controversy, and, you know, it was considered kind of a hot button topic, and I think a lot of people just don't fully really understand what it is. So we have two experts here, and I'm really excited to have you guys talk about what you do. So
awesome.
Yeah, welcome. Let's see here. So Igna. Mm-hmm. You were the first contact that I got in touch with. Tell me a little bit about your story and how you got to where you are today and the work you're doing. You're a professor at Gonzaga, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, so let's see. I always thought I was going to be a lawyer, and that happened. I'm actually writing a Black Lens article about this right now. I'm not sure that I actually ever really chose that. Or people just kept telling me, oh, you would be a good lawyer. So I was reflecting on, did I actually choose that profession? Or was I just so influenced by the people around me that it sort of chose me? But regardless, I went straight through from undergrad into law school and then quickly into a job with legal services, which for those of you who don't know, is serving folks who can't afford to pay a lawyer. And they provide free services. And my first job was working with victims of domestic violence. And I had an immediate entry into a job that I was way in over my head on. And what it revealed to me very quickly was a massive dissatisfaction with what I was seeing in terms of outcomes for not just my own clients, but for entire families. And what I saw was a system that couldn't respond to the needs of the people that were going through it. And actually, that was exacerbating problems for those families, because you have a family unit who, for better or worse, although they're having problems in the current moment, they're going to live their lives together. And a legal system is, by contrast, an adversarial system that is designed, if it goes to a trial, to basically point out the other parent's inability to be the best parent. And if you put people into that space with one another and tear down each other's skills and aptitude and capacity as a parent, it really creates long-term damage. And so essentially, my first job taught me really quick that I wasn't being part of a system that I thought would be used to change things for the better. And that it just wasn't innovative and inventive and generative enough of a profession to be responsive to the real needs of the people that it was serving. And that wasn't going to work for me. So I found another job where they literally pay me to be critical about the law and the legal system. They pay me to write articles about it. It's a really sweet gig. And I don't want to just write negative. I want to find things that are closer to working. And I'm not going to say that things that work, because I don't necessarily know that there is any one thing that works, but things that move us experimentally to ways of being with one another that connect us rather than disconnect us.
Great intro. I'm going to come back to some things you said there. This is perfect, because one of the things that's been occupying always is just like in my mind, but in spending any time looking into social issues and specifically things related to what one would call, I guess, I don't know, social services or people with needs in the community, that when they go to the legal system is just not equipped to fully and appropriately respond. And it's like, I just keep running into stories about this, about many different topics, whether it's, you know, intimate partner abuse and violence, child abuse, hate crimes, etc. There just seems to be this constant thing of like, it goes to court, but then nothing satisfying happens. And it's, you're the perfect person I want to have on the air today. So this is going to be good. Julie, tell us a little bit about your background as well.
Yeah. So I also started out in law. I'm a recovering attorney. So I started out, as an attorney, and just really do actually, looking back, appreciate, the lens that education gave me. I started out actually working for a local nonprofit, Center for Justice. So I was working to support individuals who were cycling in and out of our incarceration system. So our local criminal system, our jails and prisons, and supporting them as they were trying to re-enter the community and overcome barriers to becoming a part of the community again, like with driver's licenses, housing, employment. And like Inga, their stories just really made me realize that the criminal justice system was not necessarily meeting the needs of either the people who were, you know, convicted of causing harm or accused of causing harm, or the people who had been harmed. And so through the stories of my clients, I really just also became dissatisfied with what the criminal justice system was providing in terms of a response to harm, and became interested in restorative justice. And so really became a student of restorative justice, and it kind of just became started facilitating restorative processes with clients and others, and became interested in how to implement more of these principles and values into our local criminal justice system. From there, I moved into working with Spokane Public Schools. So I was the restorative practices and mediation program manager for Spokane Public Schools for a few years, and loved, you know, working on ways to implement restorative practices into K through 12 education with students, families, staff, when there is harm, and using these principles actually as a way to also prevent conflict and respond to conflict and harm in a way that really strengthens our community, strengthens relationships. So, yeah, and now I help facilitate restorative processes and, yeah, love this work and appreciate the opportunity to talk about it and help people understand what it is and what it isn't. So. Mm.
That's great. Thank you for leading with that. So right away, I want to jump kind of like right into the meat and potatoes of the conversations. You guys both had experiences where you went into the legal, like the law, not industry, that's not the right word, but into that, the world of like law and through the mainstream traditional path, you quickly found that it wasn't maybe doing or operating the way you thought it would, and like the justice system wasn't providing the justice it is supposed to, and if that's kind of my interpretation. And so you had to find alternative ways to try to reform the obstacles and the issues that you were seeing that are blocking the legal system for operating more effectively towards justice and towards redeeming harm rather than causing more of it. And I want to ask next, like, so what, before I go into that, let's see, I want to spend some time talking about like, what are the main patterns that you see? Like, what are the main issues and obstacles that you see, and what are the, you know, what's coming up? That's probably a huge question, and there's probably a lot to it, and we won't even have time to get into like all of it if we had spent the whole hour talking about that, right? But if you can give kind of like a synopsis, like what are the problematic patterns that keep coming up? But before we do move into that, can you give us just like a quick definition of what restorative justice even is? What is restorative justice? How do you define it?
Julie's giving me the eyes. I was trying to give them to her. We have some little quips that we like to say, like restorative justice is a paradigm, not a process. But I like to talk about it as essentially it's direct conflict ownership. So when harm occurs, and it's not only from the lens of a harm. Like restorative justice has developed practices to prevent harm, as Julie said earlier, and to create more community and to create essentially a more resilient community so that harm doesn't occur in the first place, so it can be preventative. But in sort of its classic form, when we're talking about quote unquote restorative justice, the idea is that the conflict belongs to those who are closest to it. And those are the people who have the solutions and the capacity, potentially the capacity to solve for the problem or to essentially try to make amends for the harm that was caused. Mm-hmm. So I want people to understand though, because people hear that and then immediately like the brain starts ticking down. Well, what if I'm not ready to have that conversation? What if I never want to see the person who caused harm again? What if I, you know, I'm not safe with the person who caused harm? What if I, and all of those things, right, are valid. And all of it's not a panacea or a one size fits all. It is when appropriate, if the person who caused harm and recognizes that they caused harm and can take accountability for that harm wants to enter into, and the person who has been harmed primarily wants to enter into a conversation or a dialogue to confront the harm that was caused and for the person who caused that harm to essentially be able to receive and hear the impacts of the way that that harm has now lived itself out into the world through the lens of the person who was harmed. So think about it, sitting across from the person who caused you harm and looking them in the eyes and detailing and explaining how what they have done has impacted you and what kind of an impact it's had on your life. And for that person to be able to sit and to receive that and then to be able to respond. And ultimately, the goal is if you have a person who has capacity to take accountability for their actions, that there could be potentially forward movement. So now that I've heard the ways that I've harmed you, how could I essentially make up for those harms? It's not to say that I can put you back into the place you were before, because that's likely not possible, but how can we move towards atonement, or how could we move towards restoration of that brokenness or that broken relationship? And that's if you have an existing relationship. There are also times when harm is done and committed right between strangers. In that case, if there is a restorative dialogue that goes forward, it's usually victim-driven or victim or survivor-driven. And it's usually because that person is stuck and they have questions. And the only person who can answer those questions is the person who actually committed the harm. And so there's a lot of questions about why did you do it? Do you understand what causing me that kind of harm has done for me in my life? How do I know that you'll never do this again to someone else? How can you assure me of that? So the assurance of non-recurrence is also very big for people who have been harmed. And so kind of not like super short, as you asked, but that's kind of the shortest I got. You got something else, Julie?
Yeah, I would just say there's a tremendous amount of pre-work that goes into a dialogue that Inga just described. And so, you know, listening to that, it could be like, oh gosh, like what if it goes wrong? Or that sounds intense, which it is, but these processes are so driven by the individuals that the facilitator, the restorative justice facilitator, is meeting individually with each party probably multiple times over the span of whatever amount of time people need to feel ready to engage in a dialogue like that. And these processes can take years to actually come together into a dialogue because, and every time that facilitator is meeting with the individual, that individual is feeling heard, is helping to understand their story, is determining the when and the how. So it's very driven by the individuals who are impacted. And so as a facilitator, you know, I would never want to facilitate a dialogue if I felt that it would cause additional harm based on what I've heard from the people who are interested in participating. So, you know, the process really starts with those individual conversations to figure out what do people need? Is this type of dialogue going to be responsive to their needs? And is it, you know, likely to help them move forward on their journey? And so, yeah, that's a big piece of it as well. And I think leading into what you said about what are some of the obstacles, I think restorative justice by its very nature requires us to slow down and to take time to engage in meaningful conversations and to listen, because everyone has different needs. One person who's harmed is going to have very different needs than another person who maybe felt a very similar harm. Like, it's going to look very, very different for each individual. And that just takes, it takes time. It takes time to slow down and listen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. The world we live in is increasingly unforgiving to slowing down, mm-hmm. of course. So yeah, I want to keep expanding on that, but so just to kind of dig a little deeper in a couple things you guys mentioned. So from what I'm hearing, the it sounds like most of the work that you do, the clients that you work with, you're dealing with situations that are deeply like interpersonal. So family relations, and the such. Is that right? Or is it kind of, I know Igna, you said, given your background with, domestic abuse survivors, I think that definitely makes a lot of sense. And I have a lot of questions about how you would even get somebody to enter. I don't know. How many people are ever actually willing to, like, people who are the wrongdoers, how many people are ever actually, like, willing to go through that process and be held accountable? Because this will lead into my questions about, like, when you take this... this concept and apply it to a whole large-scale society-wide restorative justice, which is, I think, where the conversation has really been. But before we can even do that, what do you see? Like, how often are people ever actually willing to be held accountable when they've done something wrong, to engage in this process? How often does it even actually happen? Because, like, my cynical self is like, everybody is terrible, everyone sucks, like, it's not, like, I hate everybody.
Well, it's interesting, girl. Just even, you know, the terminology being held accountable.
They're holding because, themselves accountable.
Because that implies passivity. So... a system, a criminal justice system, a disciplinary system will hold someone accountable, but restorative justice requires the person to actively take accountability. So it's that shift from being held accountable to taking accountability. And actually what we find is that is an incredible opportunity for people who have caused harm to transform their shame and really move through that and come out the other side as, I mean, we are all complicated people. No one wants to be judged based on, you know, their worst mistake. And so the process allows us to be fully human and to be more than just our actions. And, you know, what we see is people who choose to participate in it, there's a tremendous amount of healing that comes for the person who caused the harm, to move through that, to actively do something to repair and to be seen as a whole person. So, you know, and I've done this work in a lot of different environments. So, you know, with kind of people who have been criminal justice system involved, but also with a lot of young people in our schools. And it's incredible what people are capable of when given the opportunity and when they feel like the process is going to be fair and is going to see their inherent dignity. And that's where a lot of the pre-work comes in and building that rapport and trust and helping people understand what this is and what it isn't.
I think, though, that does connect to one of your earlier points about barriers or problems within the legal systems and structures. It's just that we don't really have ways of doing this in our society. That's restorative justice and restorative practices are ancient practices, right? They are indigenous practices which have been adapted for the modern world when people were more interconnected and communal. These practices are theirs and we borrow them. And, you know, we're eternally grateful that people have safeguarded these practices and brought them forward for us to use. But the idea, right, behind it is, unfortunately, many of the systems that we've built, many of our ways of being in the world today, in this American environment that exists, are antithetical to deep connection, are antithetical to structures that allow us to connect with our bodies, not just our mind palaces, and deeply sort of feel who we are and our worthiness. And also to, once there has been a rupture, what does it look like? How do I get back to somebody that I've harmed or that I've been harmed by, right? There aren't many pathways and models for that And the ones that exist are pretty toxic, yeah. Right? I deny, I ignore, I repress, I, I make light of it.
It's all avoidance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Why do you think this is? Why is everything, in general, why do you think our culture is so, resistant or, I guess, currently inept at creating bridges and those healing pathways versus escalative pathways? Mm-hmm. 'Cause everything is inflammatory, it seems like, in our current culture. And we didn't get here overnight. No. This isn't new. The state of our society and the conflict and division that you see now is unique to our time, but it didn't happen overnight. So there's just something, there are a lot deeper things going on, a deep history of inequality and division and corruption, greed, etc. And it's not unique to the United States either. We could, mm-hmm. End up talking about all of human history and human nature. Mm-hmm. But, why in the American legal system does it seem like, and from my perspective, it just seems like, especially with civil type disputes, honestly, anything, it just seems like the biggest, there isn't a lot of emphasis on people actually being helped and getting support and a human centered, how can we make life better for these humans? It's all, how can we clean our hands of this at the fastest rate possible? And it just seems like a very unforgiving, uncaring system. And why is it like this? Why are things like this?
Such a good question.
Yeah, that is the question.
What are your thoughts? You don't have to have an expert opinion on this, yeah. or insight, but just what does your gut tell you? What have you personally seen?
I think a lot of it is, I can take myself for an example. I've been given the blueprint for success, right? go to college, mm-hmm. get a job, be financially successful, don't need too much from anybody.
Pull yourself up by the bootstraps.
Yeah. Don't be too much of a burden on anyone else. Mask anything that appears kind of as too much weakness, and then there's all the layers, of course, that you put on top of that, with being a woman, in this society and in this world, and the ways that we're expected to nurture and care, at our expense.
My eyes just rolled back so far in my skull, it hurt.
And how, frankly, all of that, labor is just completely unaccounted for, yet holds everything together. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that what we have essentially created and responded to societally. And I don't think that's to say there are people who are creating different realities, but the majority of us are sort of responding to these grooved tracks that we have been told are appropriate for us. There are people who question those, but you question those at a great expense to yourself. And at the expense of being removed from community when all we want is connection. And that is often too great a price to pay for people. And so people it's rare that people experiment. It's rare that people find ways to connect on deeper levels. It's rare that people step away from these grooved tracks of what success looks like and dive into what true wellness looks like for themselves. In your body, a felt experience, a lived experience of being connected to what's really joyful and loving for us, not what we're told. Mm-hmm. And so most of my mistakes in my life, right, have been when I have not been listening to myself about what that is for myself. And I think that systems and people replicate that mistake on a grand scale. Mm-hmm. And so, if I had to take a shot at your question, I think that's what I would say is one of the things that really stands out to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, and just, I mean, what comes to mind for me is just the basic assumptions upon which restorative justice is built. And as Inga said, these are rooted in Indigenous cultures, and it's the idea that we're all interconnected and that we are interdependent. And I think in our individualistic society, for all the reasons that that is, we lose sight of that, and that's not operating in our daily life, or we're not seeing that, even though I believe it to be true. And so, I mean, I'm just thinking about when we sit in circle, one of the, you know, primary or most common restorative practices is circle, where people are sitting in circle together and everyone has an opportunity to speak from their heart and to feel heard. And it creates that, it meets a human need. Everyone who we've experienced a circle with seems to walk away in a completely different state after slowing things down, feeling deeply connected with other humans, having the opportunity to speak openly and honestly and to have things slow down. And so whenever we practice restorative justice principles through circle or dialogues, it's something that people feel and I think realize is a need that hasn't been being met. There's just not space or time in our current culture to realize it. And so it's almost like we don't realize it's a need until we experience it being met, and it's pretty profound. Yeah. So
what is a circle? Is it like a, now tell us more about that. Is that an activity that you do in your practices?
Yeah. So again, that's rooted in Indigenous practices, talking circles where, you know, this has been practiced forever in ancient cultures of meeting in circle. Often there's a talking piece and someone who's keeping the circle, a circle keeper. The talking piece is passed around and whoever's holding it has the opportunity to just pause and reflect or to share. And then it's passed to the next person, which is very, very different.
Talking stick method kind of, right?
Yeah. So it's very different than if you think about your normal, like, staff meeting or classroom or board meeting where the conversation just kind of goes based on who's talking the loudest or who responds the quickest, and the conversation can quickly, it just becomes sort of someone speaks and someone responds and then it goes. And what a circle allows is some structure where we're not just responding. We have to sit and wait until the talking piece comes around to us, and we have to notice what we're feeling in our body when other people are saying things that maybe trigger us or bring things up for us. And, but what it does is it really slows down the pace of conversation. It allows people uninterrupted time to speak. And so it is one of the primary restorative practices, processes, that we use in our work. And it's one of those things that you can explain it, but really to understand it, it's about experiencing it.
Yeah.
That's a great point. That's so interesting. So could listening through here, what I'm hearing, as far as if we're pointing out kind of the obstacles that are, they're connected to bigger societal, like cultural influences that have been around for a long time. I'm hearing about individualism. I'm hearing about competition culture. I'm hearing about capitalism and capitalistic culture, the way that it's taken shape in today's form of capitalism, and the productivity, competition, etc. I'm hearing about stoicism and dominance culture, all these things that are very kind of uniquely American in a way. They're common in other parts of the world, but these are those like tenets of like pull yourself up by the bootstrap individualist capitalist American culture. So it's I mean, it makes a lot of sense. These I do think these are values that to some level, are not inherently bad. Like, individualism is not inherently bad. Competition is not inherently bad. I mean, capitalism, when these things run out of control and they fall into extremes and they become divisive. And so it's interesting to hear how it sounds like those patterns and those values are kind of filter their way into everything in our society, including the legal and the justice legal system and the criminal justice industry, etc. So, yeah, and I love the idea that what go figure, like, what are some practices that you're using to push back against this culture? You know, ancient indigenous practices. There's a sense of almost like, well, that, you know, it makes sense, but go figure, you know? I want to hear more about that, but I really like the idea of the talking circle and what you're just saying, Julia. Julie, what did I just call her? Julia.
Don't, okay.
I'm thinking of, I know another Julia. I was like talking to through one of my work meetings, so.
All apologies. Good.
Hey, Julia. We love you.
I hope she listens to this podcast or to this show. I hope you do. Julie, that is like just such a good point. And I always come back to this idea of slowing down. I mean, heck, that's kind of the point of this show here is let's actually take an hour to think about this topic. This one thing that came up in this like cacophony of 15,000 things that I read about and watched a video about and read comments about today that are happening in society. Let's take an hour to talk about one thing at a time. That's like almost impossible. It's not really what happens anymore. It's the world we live in bombards us with so much. And what I think you see with this ever increasing pace of life and rate of living is people just simply cannot keep up with anything anymore. And people shut down and go like default immediately into reactive mode when we're being pressured in conversations that feel competitive. And like you were saying, it's like most, if we're even in a place where where you're in a space with other people in person having a group conversation, which is a lot to like ask for anymore, it seems like it's a lot more inaccessible than it used to be. So if you can even get there, I mean, I'm thinking of times of when I was in school or in work meetings, it's just one person trying to compete with the, like, people trying to talk over each other. That's all mm-hmm. that's happening in society. That's 90% of social, like, dialogue that I see, especially online, is just people talking, then yelling over each other. And it's just all knee-jerk reaction, like, people barking at each other. Like, mm-hmm. there's no actual conversation. And no wonder it's so, like, there's so much escalation. People can't actually hold conversations. And I find that to be incredibly dangerous. And destructive, because if we can't sit and think and listen, that active listening component, you really can't accomplish anything, and people just spiral further and further into reactive states of mind and go into that fight or flight, aggression, avoidance. Nothing gets fixed, things only get broken. That's what I see. So I mean, the whole idea of the talking circle, that's something I think we can all really benefit from and use, but we don't have spaces to create that. Like, I'm thinking, when was the last time I was in a setting where I had an interaction like that, where people go around and talk about something? I'm trying to implement this in my book club. Yeah. I started a book club a couple months ago, and I'm finding like the conversation. We spend like the first 15-20 minutes talking about the book, and then it just turns into mm-hmm. book club, which is fine, but like. Yeah. I want it to be an actual, like, constructive space. Yeah. So that structure, like, when was the last time I was in a setting that had that kind of structure that actually allowed for people to have the time and the space to fully express a thought, process it, and for people to have time to listen mm-hmm. and process and then respond, the slower process. I mean, I think it was probably college 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My gosh. Or maybe a little bit during when I was doing AmeriCorps and doing training. Mm. But still, like, that is, it's so rare to find, and it is so needed. So how do you go about creating more, how do we go about creating more spaces where we can create that structure to have those conversations. How do you reintroduce that in our society?
Yeah. I love the conversation's going this way, because I think Inga started off with like the classical understanding of restorative justice is in these offender survivor situations, right? After there's been harm. But what we're finding more and more, especially with building restorative communities, the work we're doing right now is these practices, like a circle, can be applied anywhere and everywhere and dramatically change the quality of interactions that people are able to have. And it's ironic that they're not outcome-based, right? Like, that's not the point. But so much meaningful and productive, generative thought happens in these circles that are really quite simple. It is truly just someone who's willing to hold the space, a talking piece or not, but the idea that you go around, ask a question, and everyone gets an opportunity to respond. It's really very simple and can be used, in families, in book clubs, in schools, in staff meetings. And so what we've been really doing this last year through the NAACP initiative is creating those spaces and inviting anyone and everyone to come join us in circle and experience it, because that really is how I think people will understand what this is by experiencing it. So we're just trying to create more of those spaces and inviting people to come learn, how do I facilitate a circle? What does this look like? What does this feel like?
Yeah. I would say, I just wrote an article for the Black Lens last month, and I said I was a proselytizer of circles. Like, I could talk a good game academically. I could tell you about the history, where it comes from, the why, just sort of the legal framework around this stuff. But it's this year where I have been in circle so much because of this initiative that I finally feel and understand the real value of it. Every time I come into a circle, I'm usually coming in a little too hot, a little too steeped in Western ideals about, because you live your life in this way. And then so I'm coming into a circle in the way that I have just had to live my life to adapt to all of those grooves that I was talking about earlier, right? Mm-hmm. I'm with my students. I'm in the class. I'm working on other people's time clocks. I'm calendared out till my eyeballs like want to explode. And I happen to have this BRC event on my calendar, right? So I'm coming in and I come into the room and I carry that with me, right? And it's always like this false start for me. Like, oh, I have a circle. I know it's going to be good, quote unquote, but I don't feel it. Like I can say to myself, like, I know this is what I need, or I know this is the experience that I'm supposed to be doing, but I don't feel it. Then you move into a circle and then everything changes. The pace changes. My breath changes. Looking at people in the eye changes how I'm able to see myself in that moment. Sitting with words of somebody else and not responding and choosing to just try to not rehearse in my head, but actually listen, changes me. The idea that I am elevated by something that somebody said or excited by something that somebody said, and I don't get to respond. I have to sit with that and self-regulate and understand what it means to me in my body. Like, there's all of a sudden there's like a reverential tone that usually comes upon people in a circle. Things get hushed, like blood pressure literally descends. People lean in and there's That's why I want everybody to try it, because I can tell you about the experience, but you won't make sense of it for yourself until you experience it, until you have your own agency to experience it and to be in a circle if you so choose, and to participate if you so choose, right? Because you can also pass, and you have your own agency to do that as well. And we will respect you for doing that, for not engaging in that way, because you're a human and you're entitled to all of your humanness. And so if that means you come into the circle and you can't fully participate, we still care about you.
Mm-hmm. I like that you mentioned the idea of like having a space to register how things feel in your body, the somatic side of the somatic experiencing. That's like something I've been learning about a lot through like, well, therapy and mm-hmm. wellness, like mm-hmm. from a health standpoint. Yeah. But it's very eye-opening to learn about it and realize like just how much I think we live in a society that also like makes us inherently like teaches us to dissociate from our bodies. Mm-hmm. But like they think like, oh, it's you got your head, your brain, and your body. But here's the crazy thing. Your head's connected to your body. And vice versa. Like everything you think and process and feel in your mind, your thoughts, you feel in your body, and your body goes into like, that's what it's like. We're all just, I think so many people nowadays are redlining in fight or flight. And that's just like how they move through life. And you can't have a constructive conversation or like, you're not operating at your full capacity for listening and processing and sitting with if you're in that parasympathetic mm-hmm. nervous state of fight or flight. So that's nerd out about that stuff too, but you know, that's also such a good point. It's like the physical spaces, the environment that you create to have those conversations matter, because you process everything not only through your thoughts but through your body. And so many people in our society, I think, lack that awareness.
Some of the most dangerous conversations I have had have been conversations in my own head and mm-hmm. conversations coming from my head, right? Conversations where I wasn't integrated in my body.
Yeah.
Because they can be cold, condescending, right? Mm-hmm. They can really essentially like, they're just massive forms of disconnection, and they can feel sort of good, like in a counterintuitive way, because it's like, I'm winning or I'm making my point or I'm linearly like,
yeah.
Oh right. Like this is the quote unquote like right answer, or this is the only interpretation. And it's like, it's ignoring the wholeness of your being, the person that you're interacting with, their being. And so, yeah, I mean, I have to like own that. I've been that person in my life, and I am actively really working hard to not be that person.
Same. Oh my God. Yes. I have entire, and I wonder if it's like also like an ADHD thing. I just kind of spend a lot of time in my head anyways, but I will have full blown conversations in my, like imagine another person, entire full blown conversations in my head.
Same.
And a lot of times they're angry. Mm-hmm. Like that's where for me, it comes out in rage and anger. And like I will like literally sometimes spend hours, especially before I became aware of this, like just raging, like imagining tearing someone to shreds. Mm-hmm. And like, it didn't make me feel good, but it's also kind of addictive in a mm-hmm. way. But then I realized it was happening so much, it was actually affecting how I like physiologically felt. I was like, okay, this isn't good. Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And mostly it's just like, oh, I'm hurt. That's why I'm so angry, right? Like, oh, I'm scared. That's why I am going out of control in my mind, because I'm not tapping in to, I'm not paying attention to my body. I'm not acknowledging it. And so my brain is going to do something crazy, because essentially I'm not just sitting with myself and allowing myself to be hurt or to be scared or to just.
Well, and that's, yeah. I think the hard thing with, and I'm sorry, we're going to run out of time to go deeper into this, but like with, when somebody else hurts you, mm-hmm. it's really hard to just like, or like, you know, when you're on the receiving end of somebody doing something wrong, mm-hmm. whether it's an interpersonal, societal, etc., there's that want to level the field, mm-hmm. you know? So it's, yeah, that's, oh, I wish we could have more time to get even deeper into this, but, such a good point. And I think, again, yeah, creating that space, like once you have to face somebody in person and you have a facility space, of course that dynamic changes, but what goes on in your head, man, it gets wild and kind of scary sometimes. Mm-hmm. So, sounds like really cool work that you're doing. We just have like about a minute left, couple minutes. I totally got sucked into the conversation, so I wish we, like, that's my bad. But, yeah, tell us about the project that you guys are working on and how, if people want to learn more about your circles and how to participate. So, tell us about BRC and just kind of what you guys are doing there, and if you can, in a quick snapshot.
Yeah, so Building Restorative Communities is an initiative of the Spokane NAACP, and we launched probably about a year ago, and what I'm most proud of is that we are doing this in a restorative way, right? We are practicing restorative justice in the work of the initiative. Like, we're walking the walk. And so what we've been engaging in is just a lot of, you know, gatherings at public libraries, and wherever there's interest to sit in circle and discuss what is restorative justice, what is a restorative circle. You know, we're watching films together and then engaging in circle conversations about how the film resonated with us, restorative justice films. And so it's, yeah, I guess the best way to learn more is to get on the email list. Do you have that off the top of your head, Inka?
I think it's like BRC Spokane. I'm so sorry.
BRC Spokane at gmail.com. Yeah. If you email that, you can ask to get on the email list. Or if you're on the NAACP email list or any sort of social media, you will see our flyers for upcoming events, and everyone is welcome.
Yeah, we have
an Instagram. They're all free, and sometimes we have food.
Yeah.
We try and have food.
I see a Facebook page here.
Yeah.
Is this one?
That's it. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so you can also find out more information by going on Facebook, Building Restorative Communities, BRC Spokane, on Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah.
And
yep,
can find out more information there. If folks want to get a hold of either of you individually, how can they best do that?
Just look up Inga and Gonzaga. The only Inga on Gonzaga's campus, which will, like,
Inga Gonzaga.
Yeah.
On Google.
If you put those two things on the Google, it will produce my page, my faculty page, and then there's an email on there. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And I am restorativelensconsulting@gmail.com.
Awesome. All right, guys. Thank you. Sorry for kind of the abrupt wrap up here, because we were so deep in the conversation, but that's a sign of a very good conversation, I think. I hope all of you listening and tuning in found this informative and enjoyed our conversation and listening in. Inga and Julie, it's been wonderful to have you on the air. You are welcome to come back, and we can keep the conversation going if it works out for you. But yeah, for now, listeners, I want to thank you for tuning in. And if you have questions about the show and to listen to this show, once I update my show page, you can put "So Did You Hear KYRS" in the Google, and that will bring up my show page with a playlist of highlighted stories and episodes that I have been slowly working on updating. And if you have any thoughts or questions for me, you can send them out sodidyouhear@kyrs.org. All right, everybody, thank you all for tuning in, and we will catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.